You're listening to the Concealed Advantage Podcast.
Welcome back. This is the Concealed Advantage Podcast number 9. This is the interview with Paul Kirkman. Got a lot of great stuff to get into. Got about 36, 37 minutes of audio with Paul. So I want to, without further ado, let's get right into it.
I'm sitting here with my brother in my dad's office. My brother is Paul Kirkman, and he's a Republican candidate for the 105th District for the state of Missouri as a state representative. Paul, what kind of got you interested in running for this office?
What got me interested in running for this office? Well, first, I started going to different town hall meetings, different rallies, different events, and just being vocal about the issues, trying to bring a little bit of common sense into the debate. And one thing led to another. I said a few things at a town hall meeting, wound up on national news, and before I knew it, the Republicans were calling me up, and the Republicans actually recruited me specifically to run for this one district.
And you're not specifically a Republican Democrat?
No.
Prior to this, were you?
No, I always was a Republican up until about 4 years ago, and then I realized that the Republicans are just as much at fault for so much stuff going on today. Instead of just being a Republican versus a Democrat, I actually started reading the United States Constitution and finding out that the way our government is set up is completely different than the way we allow it to be run, and the way we allow it to be run just allows so much corruption to take place while the American people are just busy with our own lives and, you know, and complacent with our own vices, so to speak, vacations and, you know. But yeah, I was never really not really a Republican. I'm running on a Republican ticket, but I consider myself an independent-minded Republican.
Sure, sure. I've heard the argument from both sides of the issue when it comes to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution that some people say it does apply to health care and some people say it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't it apply, in your words?
Well, Thomas Jefferson, you know, I think if you people want to find out the original intent of the Constitution, the best way to go about understanding the original intent behind every line in our Constitution, there's two ways to do it. One, you can read the Federalist Papers that were written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. Or you can read the minutes that were kept by James Madison at the Constitutional Convention, in which he records the debates that went back and forth when they penned every line in the Constitution. And if you read those debates, you'll find out that the two words general welfare, Congress decided, hey, in order to provide for the common defense and the general welfare, we're giving the federal government these powers and these powers only. But nowadays, the other side of the debate is, instead of being limited to those powers, the other side of the debate says, well, the federal government can do whatever they want to in order to provide for the general welfare. But that's not the case. And here's an example. James Madison said this, and James Madison is the architect of the Constitution. He's the one that brought it all together. He said, with respect to the two words general welfare, he goes, I have never meant them to be referred to in an unlimited sense. He said to refer them as an unlimited sense would be a metamorphosis of the Constitution, which was never contemplated by its creators. And to reinforce that, there was another time when James Madison stepped up in Congress and told Congress they wanted to give $15,000 to a bunch of French refugees. James Madison stepped up and said, gentlemen, I cannot lay my finger to the part in the Constitution which allows us to exercise benevolence with the money of our constituents. Well, according to the two words, general welfare, he could. If the argument today were true, that Congress can do whatever they want for the general welfare of the American people, mm-hmm. Well, if that argument's true, then James Madison and all of our founding fathers were wrong. But I believe that the original intent of our Constitution is to keep the federal government small, state governments big, and therefore Congress can only do those enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. They were given those enumerated powers. They can only do things for our general welfare and provide for our common defense only within the confines of those enumerated powers. Everything else is up to the states to do.
If I remember correctly, there was even an incident years later after our founding fathers drafted the Constitution with Congressman Davy Crockett, where he actually apologized to a voter for spending money that citizens voted. Do you recall that story?
Yes, Davy Crockett was up for re-election, so he went back to his district, his congressional district, and he was campaigning, and there was a farmer plowing his field, and he was trying to talk to him, and the farmer wouldn't. The farmer was really ignoring him, and finally Davy Crockett kind of got a little closer to him, and
he got agitated.
Yeah, because congressmen don't like to be ignored, and neither do the American people,
right?
Which is why this farmer said, "So you know what, sir, you gave away $5,000, and it wasn't yours to give. The Constitution doesn't allow you, like James Madison said." This guy told Davy Crockett, a sitting congressman, "The Constitution does not give you the authority to be benevolent with our money. That money is given to you by us so you can provide for our common defense and general welfare, not so you can exercise charity. It's not yours to just give away."
Right.
Davy Crockett, realizing the truth of what he was hearing, apologized to the man and said he would never, ever do it again.
And let's face it, the way that they're wanting to give away healthcare right now is charity, because they're wanting to give away something that they don't have and something that, if it passes, my children's children will be paying for it in years to come.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is they're trying to redistribute wealth for the sake of our health, but they don't have the authority to do that. What they're doing is they're turning healthcare into a right. Healthcare, by the standard of healthcare providers and insurance, that's not a right. That falls into the goods and services category. So if the federal government wants to take our money in order to provide goods and services for something outside of their enumerated powers, then that's a charitable event. They might as well just be giving us money in a check form so we can buy our own insurance. It's really the same thing.
Right.
They don't have the authority to do that in the Constitution.
Paul, what would you say to your critics that say that it's hypocritical for you to even speak on this issue since you've got VA health benefits?
Well, the first thing I tell them is the only people that have VA health benefits are people on active duty, in reserves, or people that put in 20 years plus and retired. Those are the only people. Right now, I am off contract. I'm not in the military right now, but I did serve 10 years. Right now, I'm not in at all. I do not have any VA benefits. And even if I did, for these guys that are in the military or they retire from the military, there's no difference in that, in the health benefits that anybody else gets for their job.
Right.
In order to provide for the common defense of the nation, sure, we have to have healthy troops.
Right.
So that's what I would say to him. Use your head.
At this point, you have no VA health benefits.
No, I have no VA health benefits.
Will you be entitled to them in the future?
No.
Not unless for some reason they find a combat-related illness.
Yeah,
or service-related illness.
If they found a combat or service-related illness, that'd be fine. But, I mean, if I got sick or if I got cancer, I couldn't just go there to the VA and say, "Hey, I've got cancer, do something for me." They would turn me away and they would say, "You need to go to a civilian hospital."
Unless,
right,
of course,
now
you could prove that
I'm
it was service-related.
Right, right.
So, basically, you don't have VA health care benefits. And at this point, you're healthy and you don't have any war-related or service-related injuries, so
right,
you'll probably never have VA health benefits. So basically, the people that are saying this are speaking ignorantly. And when I say ignorantly, I'm not saying they're stupid, I'm just saying they just don't know. They
right,
don't have the facts. Okay, I'm glad we cleared this up, because I've seen a lot of talk on the internet, the comments posted on YouTube and such as that about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, to be honest with you, I didn't know. I didn't know if you had VA benefits or not.
Well, let me tell you, though. When I was on active duty and I was getting treated by the military, it's not quite the standards that they have in the free market, The federal government, it's kind of a running joke in the military. You know, we buy our rifles from the lowest bidder.
Sure.
You know? I mean, they look for the most inexpensive way to do things.
Well, as a police chief, I see that in my own department. Sometimes
troops
I have no
are
choice.
Expendable.
Sure.
I mean, if something happened to me and I died, it would not be the biggest deal. It's not like the military can't perform without Sergeant Kurtman.
Right.
So it's not like they're so concerned about making sure I have the best care and equip in vaccines and the best medical care possible. I mean, they do take care of us. But the thing is there's been times where I was on active duty where I went to get treated for something, and I know for a fact if I was at home in a civilian hospital, I would have been seen a whole lot faster, and I would have been treated a whole lot better, and I probably would have been given all kinds of information. Hey, we have this, this, and this is a new thing, and you can try this.
These are your options.
Yeah, here's your options. But you know what? When you're in the military, you don't have any options. You know what? When people are on the public option, there is no option.
Yeah.
I mean, one option. If all you have is one option, it's not really an option. And that's exactly how it's going
to
be.
That's exactly right. Okay, now let's get into why I really wanted to have this interview with you. There are people out there, and a lot of Democrats and Republicans, we're not going to encroach upon your Second Amendment rights because we believe that you have the right to protect yourself and the right to hunt. First of all, to say it's a right to hunt is a false smokescreen. They're blowing stupidity in our face when they mm-hmm. say we're going to protect your right to hunt. But in all fairness and in all honesty, the Second Amendment was not to protect the individual from the common criminal. You know what I'm getting at.
I know. Yeah, I know exactly what you're
getting. Why don't you tell us what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they created the Second Amendment?
Sure will. When the Bill of Rights was first introduced in the halls of Congress, it went back and forth between Congress and the Senate. And the most debated of the amendments was the Second Amendment. And it wasn't because they were debating the pros and cons of the right to bear arms. What they were debating was they wanted to make sure it was worded so carefully that the federal government could by no means stretch the Second Amendment to reinterpret it to mean anything else. In other words, our Founding Fathers wanted to make sure that our right to keep and bear arms was grounded. It was absolute. It was the most understood, most common sense amendment, the most common sense constitutionally guaranteed right that we have. That's why it was so debated. They went back and forth and, well, how should we add militias and conscription, and how should we add the right to keep and bear arms and just leave it there? Well, then they finally, after about, you know, five or six times, or however many times it took, they said a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, those two things go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state. First of all, the Second Amendment, our Founding Fathers believed that the American people needed to maintain their own militia outside of the control of the government. And the reason they wanted to...
Outside of the standing army.
Outside of the standing army, because they wanted the militias to be a check on the standing army of the new government. Because whoever controls the standing army has the power.
That's exactly right.
So they wanted to make sure that the people had their own standing army, a standing army of the people, by the people, for the people. An army of the people, by the people, and for the people.
And you know, today, when we compare our standing army to the militias that we have, the private militias, it's like comparing a toothpick to a 2x4.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there aren't people, because over the years, we've gotten disillusioned by the powers that be that we've got a standing army, we don't need the militia.
Exactly.
We don't need the private militias.
And another,
we need them now more than we ever needed them before.
And another argument is, well, we don't need the militias anymore because we have a National Guard. Well, a National Guard and militia are not all the same thing. A National Guard is just it's just another form of reserves for the regular standing
right.
army.
Yep.
A militia, a well-regulated militia, is a group of citizens, and back then they trained once every 2 months, normally about 4 or 6 times a year. They trained 4 or 6 times a year, just the citizens. Normally the leader in the community, whoever the most skilled soldier was, maybe it was somebody that used to be part of the standing army, they would have rank, they would have leadership positions, but the militia was for the people to protect America from the encroachments of an over-intrusive central government and the oppressiveness of a standing army under that government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Second Amendment goes hand-in-hand with that because they said the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, if you look up Webster's Dictionary, Daniel Webster, not quite one of our founding fathers, but one of our earliest American statesmen, he put together the first American dictionary. And so I looked up infringe. What did they mean? What was the closest term interpretation? What was it they meant when they said the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? Well, to infringe means to restrict, to cramp, or to corrode. So, my right to keep and bear arms shall not be restricted, it shall not be cramped, it shall not be corroded. Which means, constitutionally speaking, I do not ever have to have a permit to carry a gun, to buy a gun, to carry a gun under my clothes or on my belt, because if I have to ask permission, then I'm asking a permission because I do not hold the right to keep and bear arms. The government holds my right to keep and bear arms, which is why I have to ask them. Well, no, the Second Amendment says it's my right. It's the right of the people. So once they tell me that I have to ask permission, they're making a claim of ownership on me,
sure.
on my right. The Constitution says I don't have to ask have a permit or ask for permission to do it. So the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's not just asking permits. If they decide that they want to tax heavily guns or ammunition, that's just another way that they can cramp, corrode, or restrict. I believe, personally, constitutionally, that guns, the purchasing and selling of guns, should be non-taxable because those are arms. And in order to guarantee my right to keep and bear arms, the federal government should not tax me on the purchase or the commerce of firearms or ammunition.
Because it's already a right.
It's already a right, and they cannot restrict it whatsoever. Now, for instance, cigarettes. They upped the tax on cigarettes by 500%, and because they say it's not healthy for the people, we're going to try to tax them out of existence. Something that Senator Leahy, I think it was Leahy, actually said about guns one time.
Mm-hmm, when they remember that.
He said, well, we could tax them out of existence. Well, no, you can't tax them at all. Here's an example. We don't. Churches are often tax exempt. The reason is because somebody had the great idea, hey, let's not tax churches, because in America we have the freedom of religion. Well, once we begin to tax them, people are going to lose that freedom of religion. We don't want to tax churches out of existence. The same thing ought to apply with guns. We should not be able to tax guns out of existence.
That's a good argument. I never thought of that. That never even crossed my mind. That's really, really good.
Second Amendment follows the First Amendment, and we don't tax the First Amendment. Why do we tax the Second Amendment?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a right, you know, and once they tax me on it, well, that's another way for the federal government to claim ownership on my right. You can only have it as long as you pay me money. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're the mafia.
Right.
And it's not yours, it's me. You're paying rent to buy your gun. You have to pay rent.
Right.
What if all of a sudden they decide that firearms can be charged for personal property tax? That means you have to pay tax on them every year. They already do it on our vehicles. Mm-hmm. They already do it on our homes. That's just another rent that we have to pay. And if we ever do not pay our taxes, well, then they're going to evict us from our property, because in America, wherever personal property tax exists, property ownership doesn't. Because as long as you're paying personal property taxes, you're paying rent.
Right. Back to the Second Amendment issue and the arguments that are being made today. Last week we had a quote of the week, and basically I'm going to paraphrase now because I don't have it right in front of me, but Thomas Jefferson, and I'm paraphrasing now, and he said the greatest thing, the most magnificent, wonderful thing about the Second Amendment is it will never be needed until the government tries to take it away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that leads me into my next question. If things don't change within the next 5 to 10 years, if we're still going down the road of socialism, if they try to take these rights away that we're talking about, where do you see our citizens in regards to the relationship with the government within the next 5, 10 years?
I'll tell you what. Let's say 2 weeks from now or 2 years from now, the federal government, the president got on TV, Congress got on TV, C-SPAN, whatever, and they said, we're introducing a new gun control law, and we're taking away every firearm that has these certain specifications. And let's just say that in order to take, in other words, handguns, semi-automatic guns of any type, we're going to take, because you don't need them to hunt. Or we're going to take any shotgun that fires this kind of round. We're going to take all handguns are gone because you don't need them to hunt. Any kind of combat-related weapon like an AR-15 or an M16, SKS, anything like that, you don't need it to hunt, so we're taking it away. As soon as they do that, I believe that there's going to be people loading their guns, and when someone shows up at their doorstep, they're going to say, look, and I got to be honest with you, I might fall into this category. I'm going to tell the people, you know what, I have 6 rounds in this chamber, and if you think it's worth it to try to take them away from me, go ahead. Because once they have our firearms, they have us. They have everything, because where the government fears the people, there's freedom. But where the people fear the government, there's tyranny. Yeah. So once they have all the means of combat, you know, once they have all the means, all the arms, all the weaponry, once the federal government has that and the people don't have it and we're rendered powerless, we can only fear the government.
Well, do you think what happened in Katrina when they confiscated mm-hmm. arms, was this a testing ground for that?
I kind of think it was a testing ground because...
And in your opinion, did they win or lose their test?
They won. They won, I've gotten in, people tell me all the time, they said, oh, well, you know, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, they were sued.
I've heard that myself.
And they lost the case, but here's the problem with that. The deal was already done. They already had your guns. If they disarm all of America tomorrow, and then they sue us, and then say they lose, did we really win? No, because we allowed them to take our guns in the first place. Next time, we might not be allowed to sue them. The point is they should never, ever, ever be allowed to step foot in your house with the purpose of taking your firearm.
I've seen video after video of that happening there. I saw a video of an older woman. She's just holding an unloaded revolver in her hand with the cylinder open.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 or 4 law enforcement officials, decked out in black suits, tackled her to the ground, took a rusty old revolver. Why? Because they could.
Yep.
They wanted to make it clear to those people holding those video cameras who had the power. And I'm sad. I love my profession, but those people are an embarrassment. I'll say that
they're an embarrassment. And I've said this before in speeches and different things. Anybody in military, law enforcement, any kind of elected or appointed leadership who had any part in confiscating private citizens' firearms should be more than ashamed. They ought to be tried for treason, because what they did at that point, they are constitutional traitors. And every one of them in one of those offices took an oath to the Constitution. And the Constitution says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that means that even if the government thinks it's for your own good, they still can't do it.
Right. That's why we have criminals in office. I mean, that's what it boils down to. They're uncharged, they're unprosecuted, but they're criminals nonetheless.
So. Sure are.
What, do you think more people like yourself will stand up and run for office so we can get this country running straight?
Yeah, I think there are more people standing up. I am. A lot of people say that I'm kind of born out of the Tea Party movement. Not quite true. I just kind of became...
You and I have been discussing this stuff long before the Tea Party movement came forward.
When the Tea Party movement... And you were getting involved on the law enforcement side. And I've been going to town hall meetings and stuff. But it wasn't really until the Tea Party movement started to kind of rise up that people started videotaping more. And that's how I was sort of, you know, quote-unquote discovered. I'm standing up at a town hall meeting, and, hey, look at this guy, this new guy standing up. Well, you know, I've stood up and said stuff like that before. It's just nobody had a video.
Nobody there with a camera to broadcast it. Yeah.
So all these people saying, where were you during the Bush years? Well, I was doing the same thing, Joker. You know, no one just had a camera, and obviously you weren't doing it. Otherwise, you'd be on YouTube, you dingbat.
My question is, unfortunately, it was ignorant, and I use that word, people who just didn't know. It was my generation, and unfortunately my grandparents' generation, and I hate to say that, are the ones that put Mr. Obama into the Oval Office. I really don't call him president because I don't know for sure that he's constitutionally eligible for that office. Everything I've seen points otherwise. But what scares me is those two generations. They are the voting power in this country. And do you... I know that there have been people in both those groups that have come forward and their eyes are starting to be open. I spoke to a guy yesterday, Vietnam veteran, almost 70 years old, who voted for Obama. And he told me, I cannot believe what I'm seeing, what's happening in this country. I never dreamed. And my question to him was, didn't you do your research? Didn't you find out what this guy was all about? You know, people... I saw a video of people going up to vote, and they would pull them aside and say, what do you think about this program that Mr. Obama's wanting to do? Or how do you think about this stand on this issue that Mr. Obama's wanting to do? And what they were doing, they were kind of tricked the questions because the stance and the issues that they were presenting was Mr. McCain's.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see how, it's great. If Obama wants to do it. Let's go for it. Let's go for it. And then they say, oh, by the way, Obama wants to do just the opposite. It's actually Mr. McCain that wants to do this. I've seen hundreds of people on different videos on this. And they're like, oh, well, does this change your vote? No, I'm still going to vote for Obama.
See, that is voter apathy, voter complacence, and people like to give our founding fathers a hard time for only allowing land-owning men to vote, mm-hmm. white land-owning men. Well, you know, the white in the male part, you know, that was a cultural issue which we amended the Constitution. We didn't just write a law or reinterpret it. We actually amended and changed the Constitution to remedy those. But the reason behind having a property owning person be allowed to vote is because the property owners are the ones with vested interest in the policies of the administration. For example, Benjamin Franklin said that once people are allowed to vote themselves a paycheck, that's the way they're going to vote. Basically, that's what he said. In other words, if you can vote someone in who's just going to provide welfare checks to pay you, that's the way you're going to vote. Well, how is that?
Isn't that what Congress has done? They voted themselves pay raises time and time again.
Yeah, they voted themselves pay raises. Now people are voting for Obama because, as we heard on the radio, now I won't have to pay my mortgage. Now I don't have to worry about putting gas in my car. That's exactly what Benjamin Franklin was warning us about. The reason he wanted property owners to vote is because the property owners would think past, what am I going to get out of this? What they're looking for, they're going to look for somebody to protect their right to own property or manage their own business. That's why there's something to be said about that. And having it set up like that, people are not just going to vote for whoever's going to give them the most money or the most candy or whatever. To get out of that voter apathy, the only people that were allowed to vote in the first place, outside of the white male, but the landowning part, were people that had a vested interest in the direct direction that the country was going. They weren't looking for a handout. They were looking for protection because they wanted to protect their inherent right to own personal property. which means they could not be complacent. They could not exercise any sort of apathy in voting. They had to be aware. They had to be informed. That's why they did it like that. And I kind of wish it would still be that way. Might not make me eligible to vote because, you know, I only own a vehicle and, you know, but, I mean, there might be ways to do it. I don't know. I'm not going to get into all that. But that's the reason they did it, was to avoid voter apathy.
Sure. Sure. A lot of things have changed over the last 200 years.
Yes. A lot of things have changed. For example, I'm not a big fan of our elected leadership's view of the United States Constitution. When a journalist asked Nancy Pelosi about the constitutionality of the health care bill, her immediate response was, "Are you serious? Is that a serious question?" She wouldn't answer it. And then she turned to the other reporters and said, "For the record, that is not a serious question." Well, for the record, Ms. Pelosi, and I'll speak into the microphone for this one, that is the most important question that there is, because the Constitution is what protects the American citizen from the government. There is nothing in the Constitution to regulate us. The Constitution is only to regulate them. That is a box for them. Thomas Jefferson said, "In questions of power, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down from his mischief with the chains of the Constitution." That Constitution is a tool for us to chain them down. That way they can never, ever take away our guns. That way they can never, ever make illegal militias, which they did in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They tried to do that. And now, here in Missouri, our own governor says if we belong to a militia, well, we're just dangerous. We're terrorist threats because we might kill cops, you know.
I know what you're talking about. You're talking about that.
The MEAC alert. Yeah, the MEAC alert.
I got that, you know, because mm-hmm. of my position. I looked at it in a little different light than most people, the most of the citizens that got a copy of it. Because what I looked at, and this was just, I didn't read it all the way through, I just glanced at it. But I did glance at the phrases that triggered alarm in some people, and I can definitely understand how they were alarmed.
Mm-hmm.
But as a police officer, and I could tell you story after story about people who were killed by these folks who consider them survivalists, they consider themselves right wing, and I would consider them not only extreme right wing, but extreme right wing.
Anarchist,
those types of individuals. And those type of individuals do have certain books. They do have Ron Paul bumper stickers. But not everybody that has a Ron Paul bumper sticker is one of those types of people.
See, so my argument here would be this. Instead of classifying people with Ron Paul bumper stickers, or people with pro-life bumper stickers, or people that have a militia or a Gadsden flag on the back of their vehicle, instead of classifying them as possible threats, they ought to just look for possible threats the way they always have, because now I fit into their category because I'm pro-lifer. I was homeschooled.
Yeah.
You know, I have no problem with militias, but I don't think that the government, even at the state level, ought to be classifying people if they have a Ron Paul bumper sticker. Ron Paul's a U.S. congressman.
Yeah.
So if he's really a threat to follow, why is he in Congress?
Well, I'm a police chief, and mm-hmm. before that MEAC alert came out, MEAC, however you want to pronounce it, the day it came out, I had a Ron Paul bumper sticker on my truck. My truck with a light bar on top, and I responded to emergency calls. But I understand what they were trying to get across, but they did it the wrong way.
Well, the thing is the Secretary of Homeland Defense, Janet Napolitano, had a report very, very, very similar to it. And now for the federal government to be doing the same thing, and also one of their possible threats was recent returning veterans, another category I fit in.
Right.
So let's see this now. If they're going to profile me, say I'm walking through the airport, and they want to profile possible terrorist threats, forget the turban, forget the issue of guns and ammo and the copy of the Quran under my arm. They're looking for a guy who's a recent returning veteran, pro-life, Ron Paul bumper sticker, Gadsden flag, everything which is perfectly legal, but maybe I have stickers on all of those things on my suitcase. And those are four things out of five from that MEAC report that they can see on my suitcase. Suddenly I'm a terrorist threat because I fit four out of five from the profile. And they can detain me or whatever. They already did that to a guy in St. Louis. They detained him.
I remember that.
But either way, I don't think I think that the federal government, they need to provide for the common defense and the general welfare according to the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. And in order for them to do that, that means that they don't even have the constitutional authority to be profiling American citizens. The states can, to a certain extent, as long as what they're doing does not override the guarantees of freedom that the citizens have in the Constitution. The states can't override the Constitution. So even the states really can't even categorize people with Ron Paul bumper stickers.
Right.
Simply because the state cannot police our thoughts. That is an inherent right given to us by God alone. And if I commit a crime, then get me after I commit the crime. And if they see a pattern, but I don't think that there's not a pattern of people killing police officers with Ron Paul bumper stickers.
No, definitely not.
I mean, it's just not there, but they put it in there because Ron Paul poses a threat to the establishment today. Ron Paul leans a little bit more libertarian, conservative, and that means that the federal government and even state governments don't have as much power if people start adopting Ron Paul's point of view. So now Ron Paul's a threat to the establishment, therefore let's go after the Ron Paul people. That's kind of the way I took it.
Let me ask you this. On one of your interviews that I heard recently, you discussed a law, I believe it was in Louisiana, that was passed in regards to individuals who tried to enforce a federal law that went against the Constitution?
Georgia.
That was Georgia. Georgia, okay. What was that about now?
All across America, there's a big states' rights movement. And if the federal government only has 17 enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, the states have all the rest of the powers. For example, Article 1, Section 8 is backed up and reinforced by the 10th Amendment. All the powers not given to the federal government nor prohibited it are reserved to the states or to the people, respectively. What that means is that federal government, anything, any powers we forgot to give you, and any powers we forgot to tell you that you don't have, well, you can't do any of that either. You can't just say, oh, well, we forgot that we have this power and take it. They can't do it.
Right.
So the states have all the power over domestic issues unless they're specifically given to the federal government in Article 1, Section 8. Montana, Texas, Tennessee have come out with legislation saying, hey, federal government, you're not allowed to tax the commerce of firearms within our state. If they're produced and sold in our state, you have absolutely no jurisdiction over taxing or regulating them. Georgia went a step further and said, hey, federal government, anything that we produce and manufacture in our state and that we sell in our state, you have absolutely no jurisdiction over to tax or regulate. And if you decide to send any federal agents into the state of Georgia to enforce your laws, well, once they step foot on Georgia soil, we are going to arrest them, try them, and punish them by up to 60 years in prison for trying to enforce unconstitutional laws.
Fantastic.
Yep, exactly. See, now that's how we're starting to get back to the government fearing the people. I wonder how many federal agents are being given orders to Georgia, and they're like, is there anywhere else I could go?
Yeah.
I really don't want to go to Georgia.
Well, let me ask you this. If you win the state representative seat, is this something that you might introduce?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, I'm really anxious to win the election because a lot of people, I've been being told by all kinds of people, well, once you get there, just remember where you came from. Just remember that, you know, or just remember, Paul, stay humble and, you know.
Well, I'll ask you this as your brother. Don't remember where you came from. Remember where the Constitution came from.
Yes, see, exactly.
That is the
exactly.
key issue.
See, I've been getting a lot of attention because, like, Saturday night in Branson, I spoke at a tea party, and I stepped up, and I had to throw my notes away because everybody that spoke before me said everything I was going to say. So I was like, and I was the keynote speaker, you know?
They saved you for last as kind of the grand finale.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So, but, you know, when that happens, you run out of ammunition because everyone else is taking it. So I get up there, and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to take this opportunity to just, I'm pulling out all the stops. And I told the people, I kind of went through a whole bunch of constitutional issues and a whole bunch of things going on in Congress. And I said, and then I talked about the MIAC report, and I talked about the Department of Homeland Security report that was very similar. And I said, you know what, since I fit the extremist category, I said, I'm going to do something extreme. And I told them I was. And I talked a little bit more, and I said, are you all ready for this? And I read the oath of enlistment that I took when I joined the Marines. And I took an oath to uphold, support, and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I said, so take me off that list. You know, and I started listing names that they could put on it. It's Nancy Pelosi. You're an extremist. You are a domestic enemy. The Constitution draws lines, and once you step across those lines, at that point you become a domestic enemy trying to subvert the Constitution, just like Hitler would have tried to do, foreign enemy.
Right.
Yeah.
So at that point, you cross a line and you become a domestic enemy to the United States of America. So that's exactly the kind of stuff I'm going to be saying in Jefferson City. And I'm really anxious for it, too, because I'm really anxious to see how people respond to me when I get there and start pulling their punt card.
Right. I really hope that a lot of people will look at you as a role model and say, okay, this guy's doing it. I can step forward and do the same thing. Because that is really wherein lies the hope for our nation. Paul, we're running short time. Paul, I want to say thanks for the interview. It's been fantastic. I wish you the best of luck. And anything you'd like to leave us with?
No.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming.
This concludes the Concealed Advantage podcast. Be sure to check out concealedadvantage.weebly.com for information on the best concealed carry training in Southeast Missouri.